Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We honor the troops coming home from Iraq, but acknowledge that this was yet another war that did not go as U.S. planners had hoped. What's the pattern? How do we get out of it? Richard Betts directs the Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University and has written a book called American Force: Dangers, Delusions, and Dilemmas in National Security. Welcome to WNYC.
Nice to be here.
For your book, you studied American use of force since the end of the Cold War. Why did you start there?
Well, that's a big breakpoint in recent history. We had a long period of over 40 years of constant conflict without a major war, but with very strong efforts in national security policy on all fronts. And that ended fairly abruptly near the end of the century with virtually complete victory. And that was a radical change in the nature of threats to the United States and the challenges we were faced with.
But rather than an era of no more war after the Soviet threat disintegrated, the U.S. has been more interventionist?
Well, we've gotten involved in twice as many wars in the 20 years since the Cold War ended as we did during the Cold War. They're smaller wars now, but they're more frequent, more constant, and I think they reflect the decision by the U.S. government under several administrations to try to take advantage of our new power to reshape the world in a beneficial way.
Well, one of your conclusions is that the first Iraq war, which came just as the Cold War was ending, 1991, that was the first post-Cold War war, the first Iraq war misled America into the second Iraq war. What do you mean by that?
Well, the first war against Iraq was more or less the perfect war. It was very cheap, both in blood and treasure, fewer than 200 battle deaths. We didn't even have to pay the financial costs since we passed the tin cup and got the Germans and Japanese and other allies to pay most of the bill. And it was a stunning victory that impressed everyone and achieved all of the objectives that the administration had. So that was a powerful suggestion that American power could be used very effectively and without great cost. And I think that naturally tempted later decision makers to think we could get away with using power on the cheap. And in certain situations, that simply turned out to be much more expensive than they anticipated.
So the success in the first Iraq war led us, or misled us, to use your word, into a number of wars.
Well, it had something to do with it. I think there's always a temptation in American history at certain points to try to reform the world and to use American power and ideals to do that. And it was just easier after the end of the Cold War and that initial victory to think it could be done easily.
To reform the world. And you use the phrase liberal empire in your book. Do you think that's how Democrats and Republicans both see our role in the world? Donald Rumsfeld and Leon Panetta, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, some notion of liberal empire?
Well, they wouldn't call it empire. I think they call it leadership or something else. But in effect, it's the same thing. It's an attempt to shape and control the world in ways that we think are good for children and other living things. It's a liberal empire in the sense of one that reflects American tradition and ideals and values.
It seems to me there have been two kinds of U.S. wars since the Cold War ended. The preventive ones to protect America from potential future attacks like Iraq and Afghanistan, which conservatives tend to like, and the humanitarian interventions more appealing to liberal internationalists, Haiti, Somalia, the Balkans, maybe Libya. Does it work for you to divide them up that way?
That's a reasonable way to divide them. Things are always much messier than theorists or analysts like to say, but it's fairly safe to do it that way, I think.
Do you prefer one kind of war to the other?
Well, I think preventive wars are hardly ever sensible. One could think maybe of an example in 1936 when a preventive war against the Germans might have made sense. But apart from that example, it's hard to think of any case in which preventive war would have turned out to be a good thing. And but, certainly in Iraq, it turned out to be a bad thing.
Though you do seem to put Afghanistan in somewhat of a different category because the al-Qaeda leaders were actually there as we were attacked on 9/11.
Yeah, that was not a preventive war. That was a pure act of self-defense. The attacks came from Afghanistan. The Taliban government refused to extradite al-Qaeda. And the American war was, as wars go, as just a war as you could ask for, even though it has turned out not to be an easy one.
It's really turned into a quagmire, more like Vietnam than we would like to think, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Doesn't mean it's inevitably bound to fail, but the obstacles are very great. And one of the problems in the use of force for Americans is that cases in which it takes an awful long time for force to become effective are not very popular. The idea of fighting a war for 10 or 20 years is not something that Americans naturally like.
Is it our longest war?
I guess so. It depends on how you count in some wars. For example, the Vietnam War, Americans were involved in for a longer time, but as far as regular combat by military units of the United States, Afghanistan is the longest.
Richard Betts, my guest on WNYC, directs the Institute of War and Peace at Columbia University and has written a book called American Force: Dangers, Delusions, and Dilemmas in National Security. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you want to join the conversation or post your comment or question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. Do you think liberal empire is possible?
At great expense, it's possible. The problem is Americans want to do good things and great things, but on the cheap when it comes to force. And occasionally that's possible, but usually it's not. So on balance, I think liberal empire is a bad idea as a standard for American national security policy.
What do you think of the Libya intervention?
Well, this is one case where things worked out fairly well. The United States was only minimally involved. It helped, but it managed to shift most of the burden to our allies. The heavy lifting was done by the Europeans with important help from the United States. But we managed to bring off what so far seems like a good result, although the final verdict may not be in for quite a while.
Dan in Bridgewater, you're on WNYC with Richard Betts. Hello.
Hi. Fukuyama had pointed out as one of the subsidiaries of the neocons that it seems that our struggle to bring democracy to the world and so on was really limited to the Middle East. And the Iraq War was very different from the Afghanistan War in that sense, that in the Iraq War there were much more the involvement of the interests of Israel and the interests of the neocons and how Bush got dragged into this. And I wonder if you would make a distinction between a war where we're trying to respond to 9/11 and a war in which Israel was somehow expecting us to go Iraq, Iran, and put them in a position of dominance of the Middle East, which is what the neocons have written was their goal.
Well, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, were quite different in many ways. And I don't think Israel is primarily responsible for George Bush's decision to invade Iraq, even if Israel's perceived interests may have overlapped with those that Bush saw. I think the other reasons he had, including the weapons of mass destruction argument, which many have now thought was disingenuous, but I think was real. But he had other objectives having to do with the spread of democracy and ideas about remaking the politics of the Middle East that were really independent of any of the reasons for involvement in Afghanistan. Now, he sold the war in Iraq as part of the counterterrorism policy of the United States, but I think that was a mistaken identification of the threat.
William in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. I want to ask your guest about the role of oil in all this, in the Kuwait War, in the Iraq War, and even in our Libyan intervention. And I want to call to his attention, as to the attention of your listeners who may not be aware of it, where Alan Greenspan, in his Age of Turbulence book, and Alan Greenspan obviously is someone much more aligned with the right than the left, late in the book, when he mentions the Iraq War, and I'm closely paraphrasing, he says, "It's not convenient to say so, but everyone knows that the Iraq War was largely about oil." And then I'm going to read to you from a review by Ian Buruma of the Hitch 22 book in the July 15th
New York Times. We're pretty allergic to people reading on the show because it usually gets pretty deadly boring.
One sentence from the review.
Go ahead.
Paul Wolfowitz, who was a good friend of Hitchens, or Hitchens a good friend of Wolfowitz. To be sure, Wolfowitz has since admitted that oil was a major reason for going to war, and threat of WMDs was just a convenient, quote, bureaucratic excuse. When I was in Europe in 2002, in the Czech Republic, during the run-up to the Iraq War, all of Europe was convinced it was largely or totally about oil.
All right, I'm going to leave it there, William. But the point is very clear regarding oil. And I wonder, let me rephrase the question a little bit. I wonder how you would compare the role of oil in the two Iraq wars, because Secretary of State James Baker himself said the first Iraq war, which was about Iraq invading Kuwait for its oil resources, James Baker said this war is about the American way of life, which meant, you know, our rampant oil consumption. Iraq, too, at least on paper, came after 9/11 and was a preventive military strategy war.
I think oil had a lot more to do with the first war than the second, because not only was the Iraqi control of Kuwaiti oil a problem, but it was the threat to Saudi Arabia, which altogether would have given Iraq control over a large part of the world's oil reserves and would have been a genuine threat to American national security, made it part of the motive for the war. Even then, it wasn't the only motive. If that had been the only concern, it might not have been enough to get the war going. It was, I think, the combination of that with the general principle of repelling aggression that together was enough to put the war over. In the second case, I just don't believe that concern for controlling Iraqi oil in some form was a significant part of the motive. The extent to which the United States has gotten control or will have control of Iraqi oil as the result of that invasion, it seems to me, is not very significant.
There was a long period in American history when the U.S. won its wars and the victories were clear-cut: the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, and in its way, the Cold War. But in the last 50 years, we've had one unsatisfying, ambiguous situation, or worse, after another. Vietnam was an actual defeat. Central America, Somalia, Haiti, Iraq, Afghanistan. What's changed to create all this ambiguity? Is it technology? Is it different power relationships? What do you think? If you accept that whole, you know, the basic premise that we used to win our wars and we used to win them unambiguously.
There's a little more ambiguity in the past than is obvious, since we had a lot of small-scale interventions in the Caribbean and Central America, or the Philippine insurrection took a long time to put down. So not all the American uses of force were dramatic, clear-cut wars in that sense. And most of the American uses of force in recent times have also been limited, messy interventions of one sort or another rather than a conventional war, like the war against Iraq in 1991. That was another reason it was so attractive to many people. It was conventional. It had a clear beginning and end. The reason that the other cases are so messy is that they mostly involve the problem of trying to stabilize or create effective governments in places that are either very backward or very torn up by local animosities and rivalries. And it's very difficult for an outside intervening power to do that. Not impossible, but the odds are heavily stacked against it.
Tony in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was hoping our guests could speak to the topic of the military-industrial complex and how it doesn't necessarily start a war or end a war, but it is the underlying devil in the detail as to maybe why a war might not end as quick, because there are trillions of dollars at stake. And I can tell you on a very micro scale, I own stock in some military weapons companies that are publicly traded, and prior to Iraq Part 2, they weren't doing so well. And then after, and when we started Iraq 2 and Afghanistan, the stocks have shot up. And again, not that we go to war for that, But it is very tempting, I propose, to maybe end a war sooner because there's a dog in the fight that, again, is underlying and the military-industrial complex feeds off of. You need to have some kind of conflict. So if you can speak to that, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
At the margins, there may be some appeal to people in profiting that way, explains the prolongation of the wars. But I don't think it has an awful lot to do with explaining them, because I don't think you can find many wars that were started because of the interests of businesses in war making. And it's the problems in bringing wars to a close that have been the biggest challenge more than getting them started.
And yet they do have lobbyists in Washington. And when you combine the last two questions, the military-industrial complex, and we know Eisenhower warned of the power of the military-industrial complex as he was leaving the presidency, and the concern over oil, it brings me back to my question of whether liberal empire is possible. And maybe your book only looks at whether it's possible from a military standpoint, but there's also the question of the liberal part of liberal empire. Is it possible to maintain a liberal empire that is one that is actually out for the common good, however you define that, as opposed to one that gradually creeps toward whatever the interests of the empire are, regardless of what their politicians may even tell themselves?
Well, again, using the term liberal empire loosely, we've had one which is good and manageable in the sense of the smaller liberal empire, the United States, its European allies, Japan, the advanced industrial democracies of the world. And to the extent that American leadership and the solidarity of those countries is something like a liberal empire, it's one that's worked very well. It's the attempt to widen or broaden that empire in recent times to much more difficult parts of the world that's been more problematic. The interests of the liberal of the military industrial complex, I think, are largely tied to what has come to be an assumption by most Americans that we naturally have to have military involvements all around the world for good purposes or whatever purposes, and that's something that has come to be assumed in the past 60 to 70 years. There are no Americans alive now who can remember an American military that wasn't huge in peacetime. But for the first 150-plus years of the Republic, that was the norm.
The Obama administration just deployed a few troops or announced the deployment of relatively few troops to Australia to have them there just to remind China that we're in the neighborhood. We're running out of time. But among your recommendations, you say a bumper sticker for a sensibly recast U.S. foreign policy after Iraq would be soft primacy and burden shifting. I don't think that's catchy enough for thousands of people to chant it in Zuccotti Park, soft primacy and burden shifting. But very briefly, what do you mean?
Well, part of the problem has been hard primacy, that is ambitious ideas about how the United States should use its power aggressively to shape the world. By soft primacy, I mean we should enjoy having and taking advantage of the cushion of being the sole superpower, the most powerful country in the world, but we should be a lot more careful about how we try to exploit it. By burden shifting, I mean simply getting other allied rich countries to take up more of the slack. We spend twice as much per capita on defense as our allies, and there's no reason that we should pay that much more than
they
do.
We did that pretty explicitly this year in Libya, right?
Yes, but if we can get the financial burdens more evenly spread out, that would be even better.
Is that what Obama is doing? How different do you see Obama and the Republican presidential hopefuls through the lens of your idea of soft primacy and burden shifting?
Well, I think Obama is very oriented to maintaining American prestige and power, but a lot more careful about commitments and the use of force that could be open-ended and get us into situations that are harder to get out of than they're worth. The Republican contenders seem so far, with the exception of people like Ron Paul, to be much more in the recent tradition of a hawkish endorsement of a much more muscular policy. But the Republican stance on that is shifting, too. Under budgetary pressures, it's once again becoming respectable, as it used to be, for Republicans to be for fiscal restraint and defense.
You run an Institute of War and Peace at Columbia University. Is an era of less war, maybe too idealistic to ask no war, but is an era of much less war possible?
Sure. We've had periods in the past where the United States was not at war, not even using force in small ways. And there's no reason that we can't have longer periods of that sort if our leaders are a little more selective and cautious about the situations in which they try to exploit American power.
Richard Betts runs the Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University. His new book is called American Force: Dangers, Delusions, and Dilemmas in National Security. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will talk for probably the last time about the House versus Senate showdown on the payroll tax extension. With House Republicans retreating with their tails between their legs, will this turn out to be the Tea Party's Waterloo? Stay with us.